Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. It is Monday, October 30th, and we have a sports equinox, which is fun. They don't happen too often, obviously, but the NBA, the NFL, the NHL, and the MLB all playing on one day. Game three of the World Series, regular season hockey and basketball, and Monday night football. So a lot of fun stuff happening tonight. Tomorrow, Tuesday, when this podcast will be released, I'm going to see Killers of the Flower Moon on Tuesday. So I guess I'll just, you know, I'll write down some of my thoughts about it. I've heard great things. Even with the runtime being 3 hours and 3.5 hours, doesn't matter. Like, I've heard it's a great movie. I'm very excited to watch it. Scorsese, De Niro, DiCaprio, it's just all my favorites. So, super excited to see that tomorrow, and that'll be on next week's podcast, just like a brief, my thoughts on it and how I liked it. But first time going to the movies since like August, because obviously with the writer strikes and everything, things have been delayed, pushed back, nothing's really coming out. But this is so, week nine. Monday Night Football, Raiders, Lions. I actually like that game. Jimmy G's back, I'm pretty sure. So should be pretty competitive, I think. We'll see if my parlay hits. I took like Gibbs, Laporta, Goff, their overs. And I think Jacoby Myers catches. Excited for the game tonight. MLB World Series Game 3. Diamondbacks put a... I mean, they scored, I think, 5 runs in the top of the 8th inning in game 2. It was a 3-1 game up until that point. Jordan Montgomery actually pitched pretty well. And then the Diamondbacks just had a completely lopsided 8th inning where they blew it open and tied the series at 1. Game 1, I mean, they really should be up 2-0 because game 1, they were up 5-3 in the bottom of the 9th. Man gets on, Corey Seager up at the plate, cranks a 2-run homer to tie it at 5. He knew it as soon as it left his bat. He was screaming. It was awesome, like really top-tier playoff baseball. And then in the bottom of the 11th, Adolis Garcia, who has just been, I mean, him and Corey Seager might be like the hottest players on him, Corey Seager and Ketel Marte, you can make it a toss-up. Like, who is the hottest hitter on the planet? It's one of those three guys. They've all been incredible, but Adolis Garcia launches a home run opposite field over the right field fence to win the game, to win game 1 for the Texas Rangers. Like I said, Arizona wins game 2, so they head back to Arizona tied at 1. Scherzer and Bat pitching tonight for the Rangers and the Diamondbacks. So we'll talk about a couple more. We'll talk about the games a little bit more in depth. NFL Week 8, of course. And basketball's back, so we get to talk a little bit about the first week of the NBA season. So, World Series Game 1, as mentioned, Corey Seager and Adolis Garcia, the heroes here. Seager tying it with a massive, I think it was like a 415-foot home run, massive home run into the right field bleachers to tie the game at 5 in the bottom of the 9th. Seager was, I mean, he has just been unbelievable in these playoffs, getting on base at a very high rate, clutch hits. Him and Adolis Garcia in that lineup have just been like otherworldly. So they were able to tie it in the bottom of the 9th, and then Garcia, bottom of the 11th, hits an opposite field home run to win it. 6-5 is the final score. And this was an interesting game because Nathan Eovaldi, who has been sensational all playoffs, easily one of the best pitchers in the entire playoffs for any team. He's had a great run. He's really put the team on his back. And, you know, without DeGrom, obviously, they've been without him all year, but Scherzer kind of slowly coming back and trying to work into being a longer starting pitcher, you know, and getting his stuff back. Eovaldi has been like the ace of this rotation, but he got roughed up in game 1. 4 2/3, 6 hits, 5 earned runs, for Nathan Eovaldi, 89 pitches. So not the dominant pitcher that he has been the rest of the postseason. In game one here, the Diamondbacks were able to tag him a little bit. But the bullpen coming in and pitching the rest of the way without allowing a run was huge for Texas. And again, like, it was the opposite effect. I mean, game two, the bullpen let up a bunch of runs, but game one, they came in clutch. They really stepped up. Dunning, Bradford, Gray, Smith, and Leclerc all coming in. And those are two of those guys are starters. Dane Dunning pitched. He started 26 games for Texas this year, 172 innings. He came in and threw one inning of shutout baseball, only allowed one hit. John Gray came in, threw in an inning and two thirds. He pitched 29 games, 157 and a third innings. So they had starters coming out of the pen, contributing, pitching key innings, and they were able to keep the deficit within reach. And of course, all it takes is one guy to get on in that ninth inning. And now the tying run's coming up to play. You start sweating a little bit and left the ball. It was, I would imagine it was a ball that was supposed to be up and in, but Seawald, who, I mean, Seawald's been good for the Diamondbacks. They got him from the Mariners, and he, I think, was trying to throw up and in on Seager, and he just did not get it in enough, and it ended up being up middle of the plate, and Seager turned on it, and as soon as it left the bat, he started screaming at his dugout, you know, just completely hyped. It was a goosebumps moment for sure. Very, very, very cool. Tying it in the bottom of the fifth. Moments like that. I like Joe Davis, don't get me wrong, but like, Joe Buck is like the voice of the World Series for me. Because the World Series is always on Fox. I want, like, I miss Joe Buck. I really miss Joe Buck in the World Series. It's just one of those things. Like, I like Al Michaels being on Thursday night for Amazon instead of Sunday night for NBC is still weird to me. Like, I don't like it. No offense to Mike Tirico, but like, it's one of those things where like you attribute certain games and certain series to certain people, and the World Series and Joe Buck are like this, you know, they're hand in hand. And I wish he was still doing it, but Joe Davis, he's great. He had a great call. So Texas wins this game 6-5. Gallen, I mean, even Gallen got a little roughed up. He had some control issues in this game. That was the biggest thing for him. He had four walks in five innings, three earned runs. And right there, you see it. Like, there was most of the runs scored in the first five innings. It's 5-3 until the bottom of the ninth. The last run that was scored was in the top of the fifth. Arizona tacked on one more run to make it 5-3. Runs weren't scored till the ninth inning. So the bullpen for each team kept the score where it was until Seawald made his mistake in the bottom of the ninth. And then Saturday was a complete blowout, which, again, it wasn't a blowout until the last three innings of the game. They put two in the Diamondbacks put up two in the seventh, three in the ninth, and two in, or three in the eighth, and then two in the ninth. So I thought they all came in the last inning. I was kind of, I was at work, so I was like half paying attention to the game. But the last three innings, Arizona just tapped into some really good ABs against this Texas bullpen and put the game completely out of reach. 16 hits for the Diamondbacks in game two. 9 runs, 16 hits, as compared to the Rangers, only 1 run on 4 hits. And their 1 run, I believe, was just a Garver home run in the bottom of the fifth. So not a good outing for the Rangers in game two. Montgomery wasn't terrible. You know, Montgomery really didn't pitch that poorly. 6 innings, 9 hits, 4 runs. Not bad. It's not technically a quality start, but it's, you're in it. You know, you can be in it in that regard. But Merrill Kelly was, he was dealing. Merrill Kelly was dealing. 7 innings for him, 3 hits, 1 run, 9 strikeouts for Merrill Kelly, and just an absolutely dominant performance. So Montgomery wasn't horrible. Kelly was much better, And then the Rangers bullpen just, I mean, you know, three straight innings of allowing multiple runs. The final score was inflated 9-1. But in terms of like the starting pitching, it was within reach for the most part. But yeah, it ended up obviously completely out of control. So now you go into game three here on Monday night. Hasn't been played. Obviously, I'm recording it now, but it's going to be Scherzer versus Brandon Pfaadt. And I should apologize because I never looked it up and it just dawned on me to probably look it up. It's actually Brandon Pfaadt, not Pfaadt. I thought it was Pfaadt with a D. Pfaadt, whatever, but I'm wrong. Make mistakes. That's on me for not looking up the pronunciation before I even started. But it's Pfaadt, Brandon Pfaadt, who's been sensational as a rookie in these high leverage games, has pitched really well in the playoffs. And now Scherzer gets his third start. The last game he started was game 7 against the Astros, where he pitched only 4 innings, but a very good 4 innings, as opposed to his first start against the Astros, where he got roughed up in, I think, like three or four innings. He allowed like 4 or 5 runs. So got roughed up his first start, made a great start in game 7. And now here he is in game 3 with his third start since coming back from that injury. I expect this to be a pretty good game, but Pfaadt has been, him and Corbin Carroll are like two rookies that the Diamondbacks are going to ride for the foreseeable future. And now his emergence is really important because it's now you got Gallen, Kelly, and if Pfaadt's good, then he's going to be there for a while. But the Diamondbacks have a lot to look forward to, obviously. I would expect the Rangers to try and jump on the kid early. I would expect them to be aggressive early on in the counts, or maybe take an approach where it's like the first inning, let's see if the kid could throw strikes. You know, it's the World Series, game 3, it's tied 1-1. We have our veteran on the mound. He's going to be like comfortable in that environment, or more comfortable than Pfaadt is. Let's see if the rookie can throw strikes. You know, so they're either going to be, there's really two trains of thought, either going to be super patient and make him throw strikes, or they're going to be super aggressive and try and jump on him early. Ideally, you have like a nice mix. You know, the guys at the top of the order, like Semien, who's not been very productive at all of this entire playoff run, he should probably be a little more passive. You know, try and take some pitches, make him throw strikes. Corey Seager and Garcia, on the other hand, like those are two guys, be aggressive. You know, he throws you a good pitch, swing at it. Because those are guys that he's probably not going to throw many good pitches to. He's going to kind of be very careful pitching to those dudes. So if they see pitches that they get early in the count, swing. But, you know, Semien and those other guys at the top of the lineup, they should be a little bit more patient. I know Seager bats third. Either second or third. I think sometimes it switches depending on who's pitching. But yeah, some should be aggressive. Some should just look to get on base. I know it's kind of like a little weird how I'm saying it, but basically be aggressive or make him throw strikes. I think those are the two approaches that are the most possible. If it's me, I'm trying to be aggressive. If the kid throws me a good pitch, first pitch, I'm not taking a first called strike. I'm swinging at it. You know, I want to, it could backfire, obviously, because you get in the first inning, you try and be aggressive. If you don't get on base, you don't get hits. Now the kid's cruising. He's like, all right, they're not teeing up my stuff. I feel all right. But that's like the risk reward kind of thing. But you also don't want to let him get in a groove. And, you know, this obviously applies to all pitchers and how you kind of approach them. But with him being a rookie, again, World Series, tied 1-1, home crowd, like he's going to have nerves. I would, if he came out and was like completely dominant, in control of his stuff, and looked great, then that's just like, you're built different, dude. Kudos to you. But I think those nerves might get him a little bit, and that's why Scherzer will probably have the advantage, at least in the first three innings, I'll give it. But I would be aggressive. Jump on his stuff, make him throw strikes. And if you jump on his stuff and you're successful, now all of a sudden he's not putting stuff in the middle of the plate. Then you start working the walks. Then you get a little bit more passive. You know, let him try and pitch around you. Let him, don't chase after stuff. And obviously it's all easier said than done, but that's where I'm looking at for game three. That's the matchup that I'm looking for, is really Brandon Pfaadt. Let's see what the kid can do. Because again, he's been sensational all playoffs for the Diamondbacks. But I want to see what he does against, I mean, the Rangers are aggressive. Like, Seager hit that two-run homer, first pitch swinging, cranked it. So he's aggressive. Like, Seager's aggressive, Garcia's aggressive. I think there was a stat I saw from like Cespedes Family Barbecue on Twitter. They tweeted out that like Adolis Garcia had the fourth or fifth most playoff at bats without recording a walk all time. So like he's not looking to draw a walk, Adolis Garcia. He's looking to hit the baseball. And Seager has a great eye. He walks a ton, and he just gets on, flat out just gets on base. Semien is the guy that he needs to set the tone here in the first at bat, because he's been a complete non-factor thus far in these playoffs. And then on the other side with the Diamondbacks, that top of the lineup, man, Corbin Carroll and Ketel Marte have been sensational. Ketel Marte has an 18-game postseason hitting streak. Sensational. Just absolutely sensational what this dude has been able to do. Really, really good baseball player. Corbin Carroll stepped up and has been phenomenal. Tommy Pham went 4-for-4 in game two. So this lineup, I mean, Alec Thomas, how many times have we seen Alec Thomas come up clutch? He's had a ton of big hits. Evan Longoria had an RBI single in game two. So a lot of contributions, young and older, in the Diamondbacks lineup. But they are a classic, almost David versus Goliath type thing. Not in terms of like, you know, the Rangers won like 110 games and the measly Diamondbacks only won like 85. It's not like that, obviously, because the Rangers only won, I think, like six more games than the Diamondbacks in the regular season, which is really not that much. But they hit home runs. You know, they hit extra base hits. They walk extra base hits. The Diamondbacks play small ball. You know, Ketel Marte gets on first, or Corbin Carroll gets on first. They're stealing second base. They're laying, and then you have, you know, Gabriel Moreno, the catcher, he's batting in the three hole. Like, he'll lay down a bunt. Like, someone will lay down a bunt to move over Marte or Carroll, get them to second base, you know, get them, or they'll steal second base. Then they put a bunt down. Now he's on third base with one out, like small ball stuff. And you get like Christian Walker, then he hits like a sack fly, 1-0 Diamondbacks. Small ball is, the Diamondbacks are ready and willing and capable of playing small ball. Whereas the Rangers so far, like in this World Series, have definitely been, the home run has been their friend. Like, that's what they do. They have, and I mean, you look at it, Semien in, you know, theory is a home run guy. He can hit a home run. Seager, Carter, Garcia, and Garver, all of them like home run capable guys. It's definitely two different ideologies in how the lineups are constructed. Because you don't really, outside of like Christian Walker, there's no one really here in the Diamondbacks lineup that's like a big home run guy. But the Diamondbacks do get on base. They steal bases. They bunt. They play good fundamental baseball, which is something that I've been hounding the Yankees to do for some time. So in that regard, like, I respect the hell out of the Diamondbacks for doing what they do. All right, moving on to the NBA. A great game between the Lakers and Kings last night. 20 years ago to the day, October 29th, 2003, LeBron James, an 18-year-old LeBron James, made his debut, his NBA debut against the Sacramento Kings in Sacramento. 20 years later, for the start of the 2023 season, or the, one of the starts of the 2023 season. It's like the third game the Lakers are playing, I think. But to the day, October 29th, 2023, LeBron James plays against the Sacramento Kings. Pretty cool. He posted a couple pictures on Instagram of him basically doing the same dunk. I actually have a plaque in my basement of that game, that debut game. It's LeBron doing like a finger roll layup over a couple of people in the Kings. Let me see if I could see what it is. He's doing a layup, a finger roll layup over Brad Miller. If you remember Brad Miller, the power forward, the center, he's wearing a headband and a wristband. But Brad Miller, yeah. Pretty cool. Pretty cool little plaque I have. I got that at like some fair, like not fair, like an amusement. It was like a Dave and Buster's place, but it wasn't Dave and Buster's. It was this place down the road from me. It wasn't like a chain place, but it was in that similar thing where they had like outside, there was like a couple roller coasters and teacup rides and stuff. And then inside it was like laser tag and video games and rock climbing and stuff like that. And, you know, you'd win the tickets and you turn them in. And we got three plaques up there. There's Alexi Yashin from the Islanders back in the day. Some people might remember Jaromir Jagr on the Rangers, and then LeBron in his rookie Cleveland game against the Kings. I'm assuming that's from his first game against the Kings, just because he's wearing the same uniform. He looks incredibly young, and it's against the Kings. I'm assuming it's from his first game. But still, pretty dope. Anyway. It was cool. The Lakers ended up losing this game in overtime to Sacramento because De'Aaron Fox went nuclear in the fourth quarter. He did have an ankle injury. He rolled his ankle. And I think they said he has, it's a high ankle sprain or a low ankle sprain. Let me see what it is. Suffered a moderate ankle sprain because about 7 minutes left or 7.5 minutes left in the fourth quarter, he rolls his ankle, he goes into the tunnel, looks like he's going to the locker room, and then all of a sudden reemerges from the tunnel and checks back into the game with like a little less than 7 minutes left to play. So he was like in and out real quick. I don't know if they taped it up. I don't know if he just walked it off and was just like, screw it, and like gave himself an adrenaline boost, because he went back out there and he was running around. He was shifting gears like he does, and he looked completely normal. So not really sure what happened there, but he was able to gut it out. He did not play in overtime, though. Malik Monk ended up being the hero in overtime, and Kevin Huerter. Malik Monk had 10 points in a 5 minute overtime period, so he popped off a little bit. And Kevin Huerter hit a huge three, and he's been really, really struggling. They talked about that a while. Basically, since the last year's playoffs, Kevin Huerter has been very, very inconsistent. And obviously, they need him to be a good 3-point shooter to unlock or to be the best offense that they can be, is, you know, when he's shooting threes. They're still a very good offense, even if he's not, but like, obviously they want him to be good. But he's really struggled since that playoff series against the Warriors, but he is a big piece for them. So him hitting that three was huge. And that secured the win, 132 to 127. Saturday night, the Knicks, a measly 87 points against the Pelicans. Some weird flopping stuff going on with Jalen Brunson, and then he got fined, and then, you know, he stepped on someone's ankles after he shot. They called him for flopping, even though it definitely should have been reviewed as a flagrant foul, and it wasn't. Julius Randle had a bad game, flat-out bad game, 4-15, 8 turnovers. Not a good game for Randle. The Knicks are 1-2, and the Pelicans are actually 2-0. Zion obviously looks like a freak, and I am a huge critic of Zion. I don't think it has anything to do with his talent. I think it's just about keeping himself healthy, exercising correctly, lifting the right weights, because a lot of times some basketball players, they put on a lot of muscle and that leads to injuries. And that's not just basketball players. That's baseball players as well. Sometimes like guys like Giancarlo Stanton, he's a massive dude and he works out. Like, I think that contributes to his injury history. I think sometimes when you work out muscles and you get big muscles in areas that you probably shouldn't, because you're playing a certain sport and you use certain muscle groups and stuff like that, when you work out the wrong muscle areas, that leads to injury. So with him, obviously the weight thing, it has always been a concern, even coming out of college. But his health is just the number one priority for the Pelicans and for himself. He just needs to be on the court, because when he is on the court, he is a very, very, very good basketball player. Against the Knicks, in just 28 minutes of playing, 12 for 17, 5 rebounds, 24 points. Like, he's a beast. He's an absolute beast. Brandon Ingram, I still love watching Brandon Ingram play. 26, 7 and 3 on 11 of 17 shooting. It's him and Zion. And then CJ McCollum as your third guy, as your third option, is unbelievable. If that's how, you know, if you're healthy, that's it. It's Zion, Brandon Ingram, 1A, 1B, whatever, whichever way you want to do it. And then CJ McCollum being that third option is like great for them. And then shout out to Herb Jones, who's like one of the best defenders in the league. But the Knicks had a rough go of it. Can't recap all of the NBA, of course, but you know, James Harden's situation in Philly is still weird. There were reports about how, you know, he wanted to rejoin the team, and then they said, you know, stay home. And then he was on the bench the other night, and it was, it's a weird situation. I don't know if he's going to play. I don't know if he wants to play. I think it's more of like a, I'm just here so I don't get fined situation. I don't know if the Sixers are going to actually let him play, though. That's the whole thing. Like, does he actually want to play? Is he there because doesn't want to get fined? And are the Sixers going to let him play? I don't know. Like, I have no idea. It's a very, very peculiar situation in Philadelphia right now going on with Harden. And it's just a whole nother drama-filled thing that he just invites. He invites it. That we all know his history. First, he wants out of Houston. That one's kind of like, okay, I get it. Your, you know, window for a championship in Houston kind of closed. They get rid of Chris Paul. Russell Westbrook experiment doesn't work out. Fine, you want to leave. I get that. Then you're in Brooklyn with like your two buddies, KD and Kyrie, and that doesn't work out. You force your way out of there basically overnight. You know, he played less than, I think, 30 games with the Nets. And then he's with the Sixers and you're like, I'll take a pay cut, but now I want a contract extension. Now I want to be traded. It's a whole big thing. The James Harden saga is exhausting, basically. Dame and Giannis looked great. Who else? Porzingis in his debut on, what was it, Wednesday night against the Knicks. Porzingis was phenomenal. He was phenomenal. And I'm sure Knicks fans, when he went to Dallas, it was like, he's in the West, whatever. You know, when he was on the Wizards, it's like, he's on the Wizards. They're not going to compete for anything, whatever. Now he's on the Celtics, a team that, you know, Knicks fans, those are rivals, right? You want to beat the Celtics. And he looked great, man. And now I think Knicks fans are really starting to be like, God, remember when he was on the Knicks? That was so much fun. He's much better now than he was ever on the Knicks. He's really fine-tuned his shooting and his skills, and he's a freak, dude. He is a freak. And I think, again, if he stays healthy, like he did last year, he's going to be a problem. Quick shout out to Detroit. Jalen Duran's a freak. Jalen Duran is the truth, dude. He is averaging 18 and 15 through two games. Him and Cade Cunningham. Jaden Ivey's a little bit of concern. He's coming off the bench. I don't know what Monty Williams' plan is for him. Now that like Cade's back, because he was out all last year, so Ivy got like a lot of heavy minutes. But I think it's mostly going to be like a play defense and earn your minutes thing with him. He's not just going to gift the kid minutes just because he was a good, he was a high draft pick, you know. But Cade is the leader of that team. Jalen Durant is a stud. He's a stud. Oh my God. Very good. Talk about nailing a draft pick. Jalen Durant, dude. Oh my goodness. What a freak. It was pretty funny though, the other day, you know, the Pistons, they beat the Bulls. The Bulls lost game one and had a players only meeting. So that's just where they're at. But the Pistons beat the Bulls 118-102. Zach LaVine had 51 points, no assists. 51 points, no assists. They lost by 16 points. Not great. Not great. I mean, for the Pistons, obviously, it's great. But for the Bulls, Billy Donovan, I don't know how the dude's still coaching them, honestly. I really don't. I think that tenure should have ended long ago, but the Bulls are in shambles. They're always in shambles. I don't know what happened to that franchise, dude. It's just, it's been a years of just mediocrity. So we're only a couple games into the season. Of course, some teams have played two games, some have played three, but the Magic off to a 2-0 start. Granted, they played the Trailblazers and the Rockets, but still 2-0 is 2-0. The Pacers are 2-0. Boston, it's 2-0. And then in the West, Denver's 3-0. The Pelicans are 2-0. And Dallas is 2-0. Suns are 2-1. Golden State, Sacramento, 2-1. Yeah, I mean, Memphis, remember, they don't have Ja Morant for the first 25 games of this season, which is a lot. It's a lot of games. They're 0-3. So not looking good without him. Moving on to the NFL week 8 now. Bills beat the Bucks 24-18. The Bucks went the only note I have from here is that the Bucks went on a drive of drives. Penalties, extending it, big plays to end the game and hit that backdoor cover. 17 plays. Mind it, at this point in the game, they're down 24-10. Buffalo has just punted the ball for the third time in a row. And they're still up by 14 points. The spread was like 9.5. 17 plays, 92 yards. They chewed up 7 minutes and 20 seconds of game clock, which means they only, with 9 minutes left in the game, they had down two scores, down two touchdowns, 9 minutes left and 9.5 minutes left in the game. They gave the ball back to the Bills with like 2.5 minutes left. Insane. Multiple penalties, expending the drive. You know, if you had the Bills to cover, you're screaming at the top of your lungs. There were multiple third downs where the drive should have been over and it wasn't. And then Baker Mayfield threw a touchdown to Mike Evans. And then the game ended. The Bucs got the ball left back with like 20 seconds left. And Baker Mayfield threw up a like 65-yard pass dime into the end zone that just dropped in the middle of everybody with no one touching it. Godwin, had he turned his head around two seconds before, probably would have caught the ball. It was a perfect Hail Mary. But no avail for the Bucs. They lose 24-28. So Buffalo's 5-3, and the Bucks are 3-4. I guess we'll start with the Toilet Bowl of New York, the Jets and the Giants. The Giants lose 13-10 in overtime. A record amount of punts in this game. It was like 20-something punts in this game. The Giants with Tyrod Taylor, he gets injured. They bring in Tommy DeVito, their third-string quarterback, who the Giants threw the ball 14 times in this game for negative yards. 14 times. Saquon Barkley had 36 carries for 128 yards The only touchdown by the Giants was scored on a read option by Tommy DeVito. But this was a game. It was basically 7-3 the entire time. Breece Hall had a 50-yard catch and run that scored the points for the Jets. The Giants took a field goal, and then it was 7-3 basically the entire game until the end, where Tommy DeVito scores a touchdown. Now it's 10-7. The Jets tie it at the end of the game, and here's how. Up 10-7 with 28 seconds left in the fourth quarter, 4th-and-1 at the Jets 17. Rather than trying to go for it and end the game there, Brian Daboll, who in his first ever game as the Giants head coach against the Titans, went for the win on the two-point conversion and converted it. And then obviously, I think it was Bullock at the time, Randy Bullock missed the field goal to win it for the Titans. But regardless, that aggressiveness, Giants fans loved it. It was a breath of fresh air. It was something that we were not used to, this aggressive analytics kind of approach to football. Because it was always like punt, 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 punt. People weren't, you know, they weren't confident in this team to get a yard. Brian Daboll has been coaching like a coward the last 3 weeks, or basically really all season. Against the Bills on the 1 yard line, he gives a bullshit play, doesn't give it to Saquon Barkley a couple times where he just doesn't give it to Saquon Barkley. Here in this instance, it's 4th-and-1. You've been running the ball with Saquon all day. He's been able to get positive yardage, run the ball with him. Worst case scenario, you don't get it. You turn it over on downs, and the Jets have to go from their own 17 to the 28-yard line. That's fine. You get the first down, you win the game. Instead, he elects to kick a field goal, 35-yard field goal with Graham Gano, who has not been good. I said he was a weapon. After his first field goal made, he missed 2 field goals after that. 35 yards, shanks it left. Doesn't make the field goal. Now the Jets get the ball, and you're in the same scenario. I don't know how this happens, but 4 plays. The first play is a huge mistake by Kayvon Thibodeau, who had a sensational game, by the way. Sensational game. Probably the best game he's had as a New York Giant. He had 3 total sacks. And it's one of those games where, like, the Giants defense for the 3rd consecutive week played really well. The Giants defense has been pretty good over the past several weeks. It's just the offense can't score the ball. We can't do anything offensively. But the big problem here is this first play with 28 seconds left on the clock to start. Kayvon Thibodeau jumps off sides. It's a free play for Zach Wilson. He throws a 29-yard dart to Garrett Wilson. And because it was an offside play, because it was a free play, the clock stops. So you give the Jets had no timeouts here. 28 seconds. Jumps off sides is a huge defensive penalty because now the clock stops. Jets get the ball back with 17 seconds left. They're able to run another play. Throw it again deep downfield to Alan Lazard for another 29 yards. And Boomer Esiason pointed this out on Twitter, but the Jets center grabbed the ball and spotted the ball, and then the Jets were able to snap it and spike it with 1 second left. You're not supposed to do that. The referee is supposed to take the ball and spot it, and that is the official designation. They really probably shouldn't have gotten the spike off, but they did with 1 second left. Greg Zuerlein kicks the game-tying field goal. We go into overtime. The Giants go 3-and-out, even though they get the ball first because they cannot move the ball. They can't throw the ball. They can't do anything. It was just terrible to watch. And then the Jets get the ball back. They get the ball. They have the ball on the 3rd and 5 from the Giants' 45-yard line, and they get a 30-yard pass interference penalty on an underthrown ball by Zach Wilson. It was a bad throw because he's not that good. Bad throw, underthrown, receiver turns back and basically lets Adoree Jackson run into him because Adoree Jackson doesn't get his head around and does like the panic mode DB thing where he just throws his hands up and he runs into the receiver because it's underthrown. Classic pass interference penalty, which is why I think, again, make pass interference college rules, 15-yard penalty. 15-yard penalty. That's unless the foul occurs in the end zone, then it should be a spot foul, you know, onto the goal line if the foul occurs in the end zone. But other than that, 15 yards, because there's no, that penalty won the Jets the game. I think the the game-winning field goal by Zuerlein, I'm pretty sure was deflected because it barely narrowly sneaks into the left upright, and like four Giants defenders on that line, like Dexter Lawrence, Leonard Williams, and a couple other guys, they were in there, paws in the air. I couldn't believe it didn't get blocked. I couldn't believe it. But it sneaked through, and the Jets won the game. They're 4-3, and the Giants are 2-6. Daniel Jones, probably, I saw reports that he was cleared to play. I saw reports that he's not going to be back till week 10. I saw reports he wasn't cleared to play. I don't know what's going on with him. He has a neck injury. Obviously, that's something you don't want to rush back. But at this point, who cares? Like, Tyrod Taylor's injured now. He was taken to a local hospital, actually. I think it was a rib injury. I'm not sure. He was holding his side. He was in pain, though. So I hope he's okay. But you got to go out and get a veteran quarterback, because the fact that you have a quarterback, Tommy DeVito, that you don't trust to, like, throw the football is pretty embarrassing. I'm not going to lie. Why even have this dude on the roster? You know? I don't get it. If you sat through that game, you were probably a Giants or Jets fan. I don't know who else would ever want to watch that football game. But it was great in all the worst ways football can be great. You know, no one's moving the ball, a ton of punts, turnovers. Zach Wilson lost a couple fumbles, like backup to the backup quarterbacks in the third stringers in for the Giants. Like it was just a mess. It was a mess. Dolphins, Patriots, Dolphins defeated the Patriots easily, 31-17. Tua Tagovailoa continues to be undefeated against Bill Belichick and the Patriots. I believe now he's tied for or has the best record against Bill Belichick of any quarterback of all time. He's 6-0, still undefeated. But this game with the Dolphins and Patriots, just another big day of Tyreek Hill, Raheem Mostert scoring touchdowns. The Jaguars beat the Steelers 20-10 in Pittsburgh. I think it might be time for me to apologize for the Jaguars and Trevor Lawrence, who, you know, I kept saying I wasn't really high on. I don't know how good they are. But Trevor Lawrence, he said on Twitter, you know, you guys, the media, obviously he's not talking to me. He's talking to like the big guys on TV and stuff, but saying, keep criticizing us and we'll keep finding ways to win. And credit to them, they just find ways to win. They do. They're 6-2. They won 5 straight. Travis Etienne has been on an absolute tear since the first game in London. He's been unstoppable, legitimately unstoppable. On the ground, running the football for the last 4 weeks. He's been since the Bills game. So Bills, Indianapolis, New Orleans, and Pittsburgh, he's been sensational. On the ground, as a receiving back, he's finding the end zone. Really, really good performances from Travis Etienne. He has 7 touchdowns in the last 4 games. So he's been a beast for that offense. But yeah, the Jaguars are 6-2. So they might be legit, and I might have been wrong. Titans, Falcons, couple quarterback things in this game. Will Levis getting his first start for the Titans. Throws for 4 touchdowns, 3 of them to DeAndre Hopkins, and a lot of them, or I think those 3 or 3 of the 4 touchdowns were bombs, like just unloading it deep to an open receiver, dropping it in a basket. He looked great against the Falcons defense that's been pretty solid all year. And then on the other sideline with Atlanta, Desmond Ridder finally gets yanked from the game. He's not very good, and he made enough mistakes in this game that Arthur Smith finally said, all right, enough is enough. Let's get Taylor Heinicke in there and see what can happen. But Tennessee at home, I said this a couple weeks ago because I thought it was their bye week when I said it, because I was looking at the schedule and who they play. But Titans money line at home against the Falcons. I said I was going to bet it. I didn't, because I'm an idiot. And of course they win. When you're right, you're right. Like, I need to start betting with my gut. I'm not betting with my gut. I'm overthinking things and it's not good. So I need to just look at the slate, bet with my gut and see what happens. Titans money line was a gut bet and I didn't take it and it hit. So that's one of those things, man, where you just gotta, I don't know, whatever. It's just bad luck. But Titans win 28-23. Will Levis, promising first performance against the Falcons. We'll see how he looks next week as well. Or they're on the short week against the Steelers, I think, on Thursday Night Football. So we'll get to see him in a couple days. Texans, Panthers. Of course, this is how it goes. CJ Stroud, the number two overall pick, has been playing great all year, significantly outperforming whatever Bryce Young, the number one overall pick to the Panthers, has been doing for Carolina. Of course, they meet in a head-to-head matchup in Carolina, and the Panthers win. Their first win of the season. The number one overall pick beats the number two overall pick, even though the number two overall pick has been playing much better than the number one overall pick all year. Texans fall to 3-4. Panthers get their first win of the year. They're 1-6. And it's poetic in that way that the Panthers' first win comes against a Texans team that has been overperforming with the number two overall pick, the second quarterback taken in the draft. Just weird how that works. But Eddie Pinheiro, definitely the MVP of this game. Three field goals, including the game-winning 23-yarder chip shot to win it for the Panthers, 15-13. And I just got an alert while I'm recording this. Tyrod Taylor's out of the hospital. He's considered week-to-week with rib injuries, according to Scheffner. So, Cowboys, Rams, this was a bloodbath. Matt Stafford left this game. I don't know if he had a real injury. He looked fine on the sidelines. I don't know if the injury was real, if it was just like maybe he tweaked something and they were just getting blown out of the water so quickly that they were just, McVay was like, why would I even risk putting Matthew back out there? But Dak lit it up. CeeDee Lamb was the player of this game, just doing whatever he wanted. 12 catches, 158 yards, and two touchdowns for CeeDee Lamb. Just flat out unstoppable for Dallas, and there's nothing the Rams could have done. And I think the Rams might not be very good. I think they'll be a scrappy team because they have Stafford and they have Cooper Kupp back. So they'll definitely beat teams that they maybe shouldn't down the road. But right now they're 3-5. I don't think they're very good. It just is what it is, man. It is what it is. You're aging. You traded up for everybody, and now those people are gone. So it's just, You reap what you sow. You got a championship out of it. There should be no regrets, but this is what you're left with. And Dallas took advantage. I did think this was a game maybe Dallas was going to sleep on, so I did bet against them. I took the Rams to cover 6.5. Didn't work out. Dallas rolls 43-20. Vikings, Packers. The Packers might be bad. They are 2-5. They don't look good. Jordan Love is struggling. So I may have been premature on the whole Jordan Love is good take. maybe a tad premature. I have seen people on like Packers Twitter kind of saying like, name a quarterback that would succeed in this environment. The Packers are not a bad team. They have Dobbs, Watson, Aaron Jones, AJ Dillon. Their defense is pretty good. The way they play offense, Matt LaFleur looks like he doesn't trust Jordan Love to throw the football until he is forced to in the second half because they're playing from behind. That's how it looks like he's coaching. Jordan Love, I don't know. He looks like a natural throwing the football. You know, he looks good throwing the football. He's not throwing it well. Like, it's not, the Packers offense just does not look good. They're 2-5, and the Vikings now, all of a sudden, after a bad start, are 4-4, but Kirk Cousins tears his Achilles. There's a video out there, you could probably find it on Twitter, but he plants his right leg to go kind of rush and avoid pressure, and you can see it's that classic, he plants his foot, and you see like this vibration spread through the back of his leg, his calf, and it's like the telltale sign that you popped your Achilles. Happened with Aaron Rodgers, happened with Durant, happened with now Kirk Cousins. So very, very unfortunate injury for him in his final year of his contract. You know, getting a win in Green Bay to be 4-4, like the NFC for them, like they're in a position now that to win more football games and to make a wild card spot and make the playoffs. But now that seems probably out of reach with Kirk Cousins missing the rest of the year. So I feel bad for him. The Saints beat the Colts 38-27. The Saints are they're an enigma, man. I mean 38 points. They struggle versus so many mediocre defenses to put up points, and then against the Colts, not saying the Colts are a great defense, but like hanging 38. Kamara had an unbelievable game. Derek Carr was letting it fly. Rashid Shaheed had a 50-plus yard touchdown catch. They looked like they were. This is what I said last week about the Saints. When you watch them and they're like, you're like, how is this team not putting points on the board? Like, look at all the talent they have around them. This is like them at their peak. This is what I think the Saints should kind of look like. Maybe not to the fullest extent. 38 points every game is, you know, even the best offenses in the world don't do that consistently. But like, you should be hovering around 3 touchdowns a game offensively. And they're just too talented. Like, Derek Carr is not a bad quarterback. I don't think he's incredible by any stretch. I think he's just like a middle of the road quarterback, but he's certainly better than what they had last year. And like, you have Kamara and Olave and Michael Thomas and like a good defense. There's no reason why the Saints shouldn't be a much better team. But right now they find themselves at 4-4. So we'll see where the rest of the season takes them. The Colts, expect a lot of this from the Colts. This is 2 tough losses in 2 weeks for them. They're 3-5. Again, they don't have their Anthony Richardson's out for the year. Gardner Minshew kind of slings it around. Josh Downs is legit. Josh Downs is a good wide receiver. Him and Michael Pittman, that's a good duo that they have right there for wide receiver. And they obviously just re-signed Jonathan Taylor, who had 95 rushing yards on 12 carries. So he seems to be getting back into form. Second good week in a row from him. They're going to be scrappy the rest of the way. They're definitely going to be, again, they're much like, who did I just say? The Rams, where they have talent. It's just not clicking for whatever reasons that they may have with the, you know, with the Colts. I love Gardner Minshew. Obviously, he's not like a consistently good NFL starting quarterback, but he'll win you some games. He will compete. He's tough. You know, he will play his heart out and he will compete. And you know, I think the Colts are going to win a couple more games this year for sure. The games the rest of the way, they play the Panthers, winnable, Patriots in Germany, winnable, Buccaneers, winnable, Titans, winnable, the Bengals, they'll probably lose, Steelers, Falcons, Raiders, Texans. So like, not a very difficult schedule the rest of the way. Eagles, Commanders, another NFC East shootout between these two teams. They played a couple weeks ago and the game went into overtime and the Eagles won on a game-winning field goal. This time, it doesn't take OT, but the Eagles win 38-31. Sam Howell was slinging it everywhere, but this Commanders secondary just could not stop A.J. Brown. Hurts threw for 4 touchdowns, 2 of them to A.J. Brown. One was just like, it was a dime by Hurts. Left corner of the end zone, back shoulder, one-handed snare by A.J. Brown. Not only does he get 2 feet in, he gets both knees in too. Like, it was clear as day, a catch, toe tap into the end zone for a touchdown, a sensational catch. The dude's a freak. I mean, he was torching this Commander's secondary. 8 catches for 130 yards and 2 touchdowns. But Sam Howell, dude. Sam Howell, 39-52, 397 yards and 4 touchdowns. Like, Sam Howell might be legit. Like, he might be a guy that the Commanders need to seriously consider building the team around, because obviously coming into this year, it was like, well, is Sam Howell like a stopgap quarterback? What does he really have? What can he really do? But they're 3-5, but they're a tough 3-5. I think out of their 5 losses, the one by far that they have to be kicking, they really should be 4-4. The one that they have to be absolutely kicking themselves about is that Thursday night football game against the Chicago Bears where they lost. They have to be pissed about that because they should be 4-4 with that W. But look at the rest of their losses. I mean, the Giants won too. The Giants, I mean, losing to the Giants, they can't beat the Giants for whatever reason. They can't do it. And Jonathan Allen was saying that, you know, post games, like, I'm sick of it. It's the same shit every year. I'm sick of losing to this team. He hates losing to the Giants, but they did. So you got, I mean, But you look at the other loss, like they beat the Cardinals, they beat the Broncos, losing to the Bills. You got embarrassed by the Bills, so that's kind of like a painful one. But losing to the Eagles in OT, the Bears loss is a tough one. The Giants loss is a tough one. I would say the Bears is probably worse than the Giants because the Giants is a divisional game. Those are always weird. They're always scrappy. They're always tough-nosed. That's just how it is across really every division in football. So I wouldn't, if I was a Commanders fan, I wouldn't be too, I mean, I'd be pissed about it because it's annoying probably losing to the Giants when the Giants aren't a good team. But that Bears one is definitely one that you got to look at and be like, how did we lose 40-20 to the Chicago Bears on Thursday Night Football? But they play the Eagles super tough. Like they lost both games, but they played them very, very, very tough. And you look the rest of the way, you got the Patriots, Seahawks, Giants again. You're going to get the Cowboys twice, the Niners, the Jets, Rams, Dolphins. Tough schedule ahead for the Commanders. The NFC East, they had a tough schedule this year. They played the NFC West and the AFC East. Two tough divisions. Seahawks, Browns. Seahawks win 24-20. Geno Smith on a last-minute touchdown to Jackson Smith and Jigba to take the lead and win the game by four. Now the Seahawks are 5-2, and guess what? They are in sole possession of first place in the NFC West after the Niners went, which we'll get to the Niners game in a second against the Bengals, but the Niners starting out hot, 5-0. The Seahawks have been playing well. And they are now in sole possession of first place. So kudos to Geno Smith and the Seahawks and Pete Carroll once again showing that everybody's playing incredibly well. And those throwback uniforms they were wearing, oh my God, they should wear those all the time. Same thing with the Dolphins. Dolphins wore their all white throwback uniforms. The teal ones and the white ones they should wear all the time. Like even the Giants, I think the Giants should wear their throwback uniforms all the time. They look significantly better than what we wear now. These Seahawks uniforms are sensational, dude. Like really, really cool. But yeah, kudos to Pete Carroll and Geno Smith once again, proving everyone wrong and showing last year was not a fluke. They are now in sole possession of the NFC West. Ravens, Cardinals. The Cardinals had a devious backdoor 9.5 cover by kicking a field goal to make this final score 31-24. But Lamar dominated. Lamar did what Lamar does, and another good win. And it's the Cardinals. They stink. They're 1-7. But Baltimore now 6-2. And I don't really have much else to say about this game. It wasn't really on that much for me, to be honest. But I mean, the Ravens are 6-2. And they lead the AFC North. They are legit. They are to be taken as a Super Bowl contending team, which, to my credit, tooting my own horn here, I said coming into the year, like, I feel like people in that NFC North, that AFC North, you're looking at the Steelers like, oh, they had a great end of the year. Like, they're going to be formidable. You know, the Bengals, obviously, with Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins, like, that offense is legit. They are probably favorites. They were favorites, I think, to win the AFC North. But because Lamar has been banged up the past couple years, the Ravens win football games. When he's their quarterback, they win football games flat out. Like, that's just the way it is. He is very, very good. And against NFC teams, he is 16-1 in his career against NFC teams. The biggest upset of the week, courtesy of the Denver Broncos. Another gut call I wanted to bet on. The Broncos spread, I wanted to take them to cover. They win outright 24-9. Multiple turnovers against the Chiefs held them to single digits. An incredible feat for the Denver Broncos. But like, you look back at their game a couple weeks ago, everyone in the world thought that Denver was going to lose this game. But you look at their game a couple weeks ago, and they played them pretty tough. You know, in Kansas City, the Broncos played tough. And you were like, all right, it was a bit scrappy. It's a divisional game. You know, the Chiefs are on a 16-game winning streak against the Broncos. But it can still get chippy. It's a divisional game. And in Mile High in Denver, an unbelievable win to bring the Broncos to 3-5. Now, I don't think they have any chance of... I mean, this division's locked up. The Chiefs are 6-2. I think this division is definitely locked up. They're going to win. But And I'm not really sure the Broncos have the juice to make a wild card spot in the AFC because it's a tough conference. That bad start that they had is just going to be too much to overcome, I think. But they looked good. They looked a lot better. Russell Wilson, bizarre stat line. 12 of 19, 114 yards, but he threw for three touchdowns. So the yardage isn't there. This game, I mean, Javonte Williams finally got the workload that he deserves. 27 carries, 85 yards for him. But the Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes, no touchdowns, two interceptions. He looked horrible. Like, they did the Broncos defense, by far and away, their best game of the season. And holding the Chiefs to single digits is no small feat. So kudos to them. This is a huge win. Again, they have not beaten the Chiefs since Peyton Manning was the quarterback of the Denver Broncos and Alex Smith was the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs. That was the last time they won against Kansas City. It's been nothing but dominance from Patrick Mahomes his entire tenure as a starting quarterback for the Chiefs against the Broncos. So to get this win is huge for them. And it's not like it was a jip win where it was like against the backup because Mahomes didn't play because it was the last week of the season or because he was injured or anything like that. It's not like they didn't have Travis Kelce or they didn't have like Pacheco or, you know, they were missing Chris Jones on defense or their two starting cornerbacks or whatever it is, whatever excuses you ever want to make. Like, the Chiefs are healthy for the most part. Everyone is pretty healthy. So this was a legit win, and it was a really, really well-coached win by Sean Payton. So maybe it's the turning corner for the Broncos and Russell Wilson and Sean Payton and that defense, that defense was good last year and they've just been dog poop this entire season. Easily the best win for them. They played really well. So we'll see where it leads for the rest of the way for the Broncos. But to come out of the Chiefs in two times in 3 weeks and coming out 1-1 is definitely something to be proud of. Again, I think that bad start is just something that they're not going to be able to overcome. But we'll see what kind of run they go on. Last game in the 4 o'clock, so the late slate, Bengals beating the 49ers 31-17. Joe Burrow is 100% back. He had a little over 40 rushing yards. He ran the ball six times by himself, 43 yards for Joe Burrow. That calf is 100% better. This is what Joe Burrow is looking like 100%. He's able to be mobile, run when he has to, and that's been his thing, and that's something he could not do for the first several weeks of the season. But Ja'Marr Chase, another sensational game from him, 10 catches, 100 yards, and a touchdown. Joe Mixon ran for 87 yards and a touchdown. Burrow threw for three touchdowns. He looked great, 31 points. This Bengals offense is cooking, and the defense has been playing really well. I actually heard on the Niners broadcast on Sunday when the game was on, the Bengals are the least penalized team in the NFL, and the Niners are the most penalized team in the NFL. So the Bengals defense has been playing very well. The offense is finally now 100% healthy with Joe Burrow, and they're able to cook like they usually do. They're 4-3. The Niners have lost three straight games. They are now 5-3 and second in the NFC West. So it's pretty crazy. I mean, listen, this game against 100% healthy Joe Burrow, like, that's not like a, oh my God, I can't believe they lost this game. They did get dominated though. Brock Purdy looked bad. He turned the ball over 31-17. Like, the Bengals dominated from start to finish. The loss against Monday night to the Vikings is bad. The loss to the Browns on the missed field goal is unfortunate. All three of these games, Brock Purdy has not looked very good. He has been struggling. He has been making bad decisions that he had not previously been making. And now he is. And it's kind of derailing the offense. Been inaccurate. Again, bad reads. So he needs to kind of course correct a little bit. I don't think he's as bad as he's been playing. I also don't think he's as good as he was playing. He's somewhere in the middle. But I think he'll be okay. They'll tweak some things. Shanahan will tweak some things in their offense, and they'll get back on track. But three straight losses for the Niners heading into their bye week is demoralizing for the fan base, for sure, to say the least, and the players, obviously. The Monday night game, backup quarterback Tyson Bagent, whatever his freaking name is, Tyson Bagent, Bagent, Bagent. He starter for the Bears. The Chargers win 30-13. I mean, there's not much to say here. The Chargers are 3-4. The Bears are 2-6. The Bears are still bad. The Chargers won a game that in a dominant fashion that they absolutely should have won in a dominant fashion. There's nothing really to take away from this. This game went exactly as you expected it to be. So I don't really want to talk about it. It was a lame game to watch. Like the Chargers dominated. It's tough to watch the Bears. I really hope they have no, I hope that was the last primetime game they're on. Thursday night, Titans, Steelers. Titans are at the Steelers. Kenny Pickett, something I didn't mention because I'm silly. Kenny Pickett was injured in his game on Sunday. I think it was a shoulder injury, but he's banged up again. So short week. It's probably going to be Trubisky. I'd be shocked if Pickett played on a short week after the injury he had, because he got hit pretty hard and he landed pretty hard when he got hit. So I would expect it to be Mitchell Trubisky, but we'll obviously keep our eyes on that. So Titans Steelers, 9:30 games are back. It's the Frankfurt games now. You have a couple games a few weeks in a row in Germany. Dolphins Chiefs is the first one. Very, very, very fun game there. And the Sunday night game is Jets and Chargers, which if the Chargers lose that, red lights, fire Brandon Staley. I'll keep barking up that tree. I do not care. But that'll do it for this episode of From My Point of View. Thank you all very much for listening. I appreciate you as always. Have a great rest of your week, and I'll talk to you all next Tuesday.